Good afternoon, everyone, and it is the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, 1 p.m. here at CITR 101.9 FM in beautiful Vancouver. And you are listening in to Scald's Hall. It is time to start the weekend early. It is time to reflect upon the week that has happened and what has happened recently. I may be a little bit late, but just yesterday was Valentine's Day. And that is a pretty big deal for a lot of people. Valentine's Day is a lovely day, lovely holiday. And given the nature of our show here where we tell stories, yes, indeed, many a story has been told, if not about Valentine's Day specifically, then about love in general. And we have a nice reading about that to come up on the bottom of the hour. But before we do that, today's very special guest was a former student and current alumni of the UBC writing program. She has been through here and she currently is working as a creative artist out there. Her name is Michelle Barker, and she was very gracious enough to record an interview with us. And so coming up in just a moment, we are going to hear that interview and we're going to get to meet one of UBC's very own creative minds. So stay tuned.
Highway of Heights, once imagined.
Sorry about that. It would help if we told the autopilot to turn off for a moment. And there we go. Okay, so coming up in a moment, Michelle Barker.
March 2nd to the 23rd, the 2013 Vancouver International Dance Festival invites you to experience the kinetic simulation of contemporary dance. Delivered to you on stages throughout Vancouver by outstanding dance artists from New Zealand, Denmark, Switzerland, Zimbabwe, Mexico, Malaysia, Korea, Montreal, and Vancouver. Information and tickets are available online at www.vidf.ca or through our box office at 604-662-4966.
And you are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM here on Scald's Hall, and we have our very next guest, Michelle Barker. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Oh, I'm great.
And I'm sure that all of our listeners out there would like to know, who is Michelle Barker?
Well, I'm a writer. I live up in Penticton, BC. I was born and raised in Vancouver. I write mostly poetry and fiction at this point, but I've been writing for about 20 years, so I've done a variety of different things. Started out to writing newspaper articles and some magazine pieces, and wrote a couple of novels that died, which was a good thing. I've written a novel for young adults that's coming out at the end of March, actually. Short fiction, some other creative nonfiction, variety of different things. I've worked as an editor. I've led creative writing workshops, and that's about it, I think.
Oh, I see. So you've worked in a variety of different things.
I have, yes.
I see. And you also have a past history here at UBC as well?
I do. I did my undergrad here. I did a degree in English literature, started a degree in comparative literature, a master's, and lasted one semester. Sorry, complet. Didn't work out for me. That was pretty much when I realized that I wanted to be a writer. And so I left school for about, well, I guess probably about 20 years. And I've just returned in the last couple of years to do a master's in creative writing.
I see. And that is currently ongoing?
It is, yeah.
I see.
I'm in the optional residency program, so that means most of it is done online.
Oh, and that makes it a lot easier when you're living as far away from UBC as you are.
Oh, yeah. That's the advantage of the program, actually, because we have people from all over the world who participate in it. And then the optional part of it is that you can come down in the summers and do workshops if you want to, but you don't have to. And so a lot of us get together in the summers for these workshops, and then we go off on our different directions and work from home. So it works out great.
Yes, and I can attest to programs like that. My first graduate degree was done in a similar fashion. I did it through distance learning from England while I was living in Japan. So that was kind of fun. All right, so how did you end up starting off as an artist? What was it that inspired you to share your work with the world?
Oh, boy. Well, it's funny. Brian and I were talking before the program started, and he was saying how he'd gotten talked out of some things. And I think that was sort of my beginning as well as an artist. I had thought that I'd wanted to be a writer for most of my life, probably. And then once I got into university, I think I let my parents talk me out of it, because it wasn't practical to be a writer, and it was sort of a frivolous idea, and it was a much better idea to be a lawyer. So that was sort of the direction I was heading in, and then I ended up in Comp Lit for a little while. Realized I wanted to be a writer, and I think that writing and sharing your work with the world pretty much go hand in hand, at least they do for me, because I feel like if you're going to write, you want to communicate, and the only way to communicate as a writer is to publish. So that's it just sort of seemed to go hand in hand.
I see. And do you have a list of published works yet?
I do. I have a chapbook that I put out just this summer with Leaf Press, a chapbook of poetry, a mini chapbook, which is about as small as it gets, with the Centrifugal Eye. And I have a novel, as I said, coming out at the end of March with Thistledown Press. That's a fantasy for young adults. And I have a variety of smaller things. I've got short fiction published all over the place and poetry as well.
I see. And if anyone was interested in finding out more about your work, do you have any online presence where they can go?
I do. I have a website, www.michellebarker.ca, and you can actually order my chapbook online as well through the website.
Well, that's very good. And what's the name of your upcoming book so that we can find it easily?
It's called The Beggar King.
Ah, The Beggar King. Sounds interesting.
I hope so.
All right. So, do you have any other further upcoming projects that you would like to talk about?
We have actually a book of poetry coming out. I shouldn't say we. It's Susan Musgrave and Mona Fertig are putting it together. It's called Force Field. And it's an anthology of, I believe, 77 women poets in British Columbia. And that is going to be coming out in April. And there's going to be a launch in Vancouver in April for that book. And I think that's going to be pretty exciting. It's bringing all these poets together from all over BC. So, and other than that, no, not at this point. I'm working on a couple of different projects, but they're not at the point where I would want to say too much about them. So,
I see. And that happens all too often, I think, in creative fields.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to talk it out, that's for sure. And it almost feels like jinxing it if I start to tell you about it. So I think I'm just going to keep it secret for now. So
I see. And we've also had other guests and potential guests on our show that can't talk about the work because of non-disclosure agreements they sign with the people who actually own them.
Oh, no, that's not my problem. I worry more about the fact that if you talk it out, then you've almost sort of canceled out your reason for writing it. And so in general, I don't find that to be a very good idea. So.
Yes. And that is a very good piece of advice. Do you have any more advice that you might like to share with up-and-coming people who might potentially be considering a creative career?
Oh, yeah, I have a few things I could tell you. I read a wonderful book about writing by Annie Lamott called Bird by Bird. If anybody hasn't read it, it's fantastic. And she's very funny. She's a wonderful writer. And she has a chapter in that book called Shitty First Drafts. And it is probably the best piece of advice I've ever read for writing, because what it does is it takes the pressure off of you. You know, when you sit down with either the blank screen or the blank page and you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to write a story, you put a lot of pressure on yourself to write a good story because you figure that it's supposed to come out right the first time. And her idea is to take that pressure off by telling yourself that it really doesn't matter what kind of work it is that you write when you first start, just get it down on paper. And, you know, you can work with it after that. And for me, that's just been huge. It's been a really, really important part of the process that you don't put so much pressure on yourself.
I see. And just to give people an idea of an example, how long did it take for you to end up published from when you started drafting things?
Oh, well, I'll give you the example of my novel, actually, which is, it's a terrifying example. I started that novel when my son was in grade 2, and by the time I sold it, he was in grade 12. I don't know if that's really the norm. It probably isn't. There was a pretty steep learning curve because I was writing fantasy and I had never written fantasy before, so I really didn't know what I was doing. But there was also a long, long process of revising that novel over and over again, sometimes really starting over. I had an agent for a while, then that didn't work out. I had one publisher who wanted it and then he changed his mind. You know, it was just a series of these sorts of things, and then I had probably about 50 rejections from publishers and agents before I finally found one that was interested. But in that process, the revision was the most important thing, because really every time I got a piece of advice and I listened to it, the book got better. And it, you know, progressively it got better and better and better. So the whole, it was a wonderful process, but it was quite painful.
I see. And you mentioned having an agent and then losing it. Was it difficult to acquire an agent the first time?
In general, it actually is. For some reason, I got really lucky, and I have a feeling it's because somebody must have put a good word in for me. I don't think that it happened by itself. And she was terrific. I mean, it was a great relationship. It wasn't as if we had a falling out or anything. But I think the way agents work in general is that they have their list of publishers that they rely on, and they start at one and they go through to 15 or however many it is. And if they reach number 15 and they've all said no, then that's the end of the deal. And they say, well, I'm very sorry, it was nice working with you, but you know, I'm not going to be able to make any money off you, so we'll go our separate ways, which is essentially what happened. But even that process was good, because she worked with me in terms of what the book might look like, and we did have somebody who was quite interested who had me rewriting the book as well, but it just wasn't the right fit, that's all. And you know, it's important to sort of not take these things personally and realize that often that's what it is. It's just not the right fit between you and a publisher or whatever, and you have to make the work better and find the right person. And so persistence was a pretty important part of it as well.
Yes, and I think that that's also good advice for people who are thinking of up and coming into the literary world, is finding representation.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I didn't have an agent in the end. Once she and I separated, I continued on my own. And so, do you need an agent? I don't know. I mean, I managed without one. They certainly open doors for you. There's no doubt about that. There's a whole list of publishers that won't even look at you unless you have an agent. So it can be an important thing. They're hard to get. I don't know what the verdict is on that. I think probably if you ask 10 people, you'll get 10 different opinions. So,
and likely so. And hopefully on Scald's Hall, we'll have a chance to do exactly that.
That would be good. It would be interesting. Yeah.
Yes. Are you in a writer's guild at the moment?
A writer's group, yes. We have a group up in Penticton. I also get a lot out of what I'm doing with the master's program, because I'm taking a fiction class, actually. Annabelle Lyon teaches it. She's fantastic. And we're a group of 12, I believe. And we have an exchange every week of writing that we're working on. And so that becomes like a writer's group as well in a lot of ways, because, you know, you present your work and then people basically take it apart and tell you what's wrong with it. But it's fantastic. It's a great process. I've learned a huge amount from this program.
I see. All right. Well, do you have any final parting thoughts for our listeners out there? Anything that you would like them to know?
Oh, my. Anybody who wants to be a writer, I just think it's really important that you persist and try to find other writers. I think the community of writers is a really, really important part of this, because it's a very solitary profession. And when you can get together with other writers who are working on, you know, similar projects and who face this, you know, similar situations and demands, it's really important to connect with other writers and become part of this community. I've always found that the writing community is a very supportive one. Even though writing seems like it would be a competitive business, and in one sense it is, I think if you're part of the writing community, you all sort of look out for each other, help each other with contacts. If you hear of a contest or something, you know, you pass it on, and we all seem to sort of hang together, and it's quite nice.
Mm-hmm. And longtime listeners of our program will recognize this bit of advice from other guests we've had on the show, networking being essential. Well, thank you very much, Michelle.
You're welcome.
And coming up in just a moment, we are going to be hearing some of Michelle's work. So stay tuned here on CITR 101.9 FM.
There's the whale, there's the whale, there's the whale fish's bow, and the whale was in full view.
Are you a senior undergrad or graduate student wanting to supercharge your professional development and meet the right people in the ocean sciences? Then register now for Power Up, networking and training on February 27th, sponsored by Ocean Networks Canada. For more information, go to regonline.ca/powerup.onc.
What sort of fish are you?
So, welcome back to Scald's Hall here on CITR 101.9 FM, and we're here with our guest, Michelle Barker.
Hello again, still there.
And we're about to hear some of your work, so can you set that up for us? What is it we're about to hear?
I published a chapbook of poetry called Old Growth Clear Cut, and these are poems from Haida Gwaii, a trip I took with my sister-in-law probably about 5 years ago now. We spent, I think, about 10 days up there, and it is just, if you've never been, it is the most beautiful, blessed place in the world. I just loved it. And it was an interesting place because I think a lot of people go up there almost as a form of healing. And my sister-in-law had just lost her husband to cancer. And I was sort of going through this process with my book where my agent had just dumped me and I was not sure what I was going to do. And so the two of us sort of got together and thought, we're just going to go up there and, you know, hike in the trees and see the old growth forest and everything. And it turned into this fantastic journey. And I ended up writing a whole bunch of poems from it. And so that's what I'm going to read to you from. The chapbook opens with a quote. Actually, it opens with two quotes, but I'm only going to read one of them. And it is Ian Lord from Spruce Roots magazine. So the quote is, "On Haida Gwaii, as elsewhere, old growth forests are perceived as decadent by a timber industry determined to liquidate these threatened ecosystems and replace them with managed tree farms, also contradictorily known as working forests." So the first poem I'm going to read is called Decadence of an Old Growth Forest. A cathedral, too, is decadent. Just look at the wasted square footage, the stone they might have used for shopping malls. And here, this stained glass. What is the purpose of a window you can't see through? Candles left burning at all hours, even when no one is there. And don't get me started on the vertical loss of space. 5 floors of apartments, at least. Artwork on the ceiling, as if anyone looks up anymore. Prayer is decadent, and silence. So, too, peace. And the other poem I'm going to read from this chapbook is called Skidans. And Skidans was a Haida village that basically just got worn down, worn away. And we took a boat. I can't even remember the island that we went around. I'm sorry, my memory is terrible. But in any case, we visited this little village of Skidans that had been sort of worn away by time. And I was quite interested in that, so I wrote a poem about that as well. And it's called Skidans. Time has worn the wood smooth, the totems of this ancient Haida village sun-bleached, tilted, or fallen. The carvings mostly faded, though on some you can still see the dulled bumps of bear claws, or where the fins once were on the supernatural whale. We are the tourists, the white man, the reason, besides smallpox, this village is no longer here. And we don't get it. Why not rebuild, repaint, plan tours, charge admission? Why allow time to have her way with history, shrug and watch the longhouses surrender? We don't see the beauty in the cedar that has grown straight through an old totem. We don't see the possibility of transformation. Sorry, should I continue?
Yes.
Okay. The next one I want to read is from an online magazine called The Centrifugal Eye, and they actually also put out hard copy journal as well, and it's quite an interesting little magazine. It's a Canadian magazine, and they have usually themed submissions, and the one that I'm going to read from was about sense memories, and the sense of scent. That sort of comes out sounding funny, the sense of smell. And it was when she put out that theme, I had had a poem that I'd been struggling with for a long time, because I'd always been very fascinated by the idea that dogs can smell fear. And I'd asked myself, what does fear smell like? What is that? Because I've seen dogs they know when a person is afraid, and it is as if they can smell it. And so I struggled with that for a long time. I had this poem that I'd written that was very abstract about the smell of fear. It was like the smell of cobwebs, and I don't know. In any case, it wasn't working, and I knew that it wasn't working. And then during the MFA summer workshop, I took a workshop with Susan Musgrave, and one of the bits of advice that I came away with from that workshop was the importance of being specific instead of abstract. And so when I came back to look at this poem, because I really wanted to try to make it work, I asked myself the question, well, when was I really afraid? And then I knew. I mean, the poem just came down pretty much in one go. I knew exactly what to write about. So that's what I'm going to read. So in fact, it's actually based on a true story. And it's called Fear. A dog can smell it. Fear. As present as that man who followed you into Tim Hortons and sat at a table nearby watching you. His eyes burned the back of your neck, leaving when you left, and then mercifully gone as you slipped into London Drugs to buy clothes hangers. Until later, when you went back to your car, there he was, waiting, legs outstretched, his black cowboy boots with the pointed steel toes resting out the open window of his car, as if he had all the time in the world and was saving it for you. The dog can see that man's smile and how quickly you got into your car, how you drove with one eye fixed on the rearview mirror, never quite sure if he was following, how you wondered for days if he had found out where you lived, and if one day he would be waiting outside your house, and this time you wouldn't be so lucky. The memory of him smells like rust and sticks to you like damp cobwebs in a darkened basement, no bottom, no edges, just the flat space between heartbeats, when all you can do is run and pray no one is chasing you like a hound on a scent. The last piece I'm going to read for you started out, well, it started out as a problem I was trying to work out. I used to live in Quebec. I lived in Quebec for about 10 years, and every year, you know, we'd have a lot of snow, of course, in the winter, and then there'd be the thaw, and you'd be driving along the highway, and we would always see one boot sitting by the side of the road. And my kids and I would laugh about this. We'd say, who throws one boot out the window? I mean, how does one boot end up by the side of the road? And so I started thinking about this, and I came up with 14 explanations for the reason why there might be a boot by the side of the road. And it was quite quirky, and I didn't think I'd ever be able to sell it. I sent it out to Grain, and they picked it up right away, and she actually has said that it's probably one of her favorite pieces that she's ever published, which is kind of nice. In the end, I had to shorten it for last summer's workshop, because the man who runs the student reading programs gives us 3 minutes, and if we go over it, he basically humiliates us, so we have no choice but to stick to that 3 minutes. And so I had to cut the 14 explanations down to 7. So it's now called 7 Explanations, and it is going to be reprinted in the anthology Force Field that Susan Musgrave and Mona Fertig are putting out this spring. So it's called 7 Explanations. 7 Explanations for the lone boot that sits by the highway every summer. Every summer a different boot, but only one. A sole survivor flung out the window of a passing car as, 1, a cry for individualism, a song of the peculiar, because why wear two boots when you can wear one? 2 boots votes conservative, drives a minivan and watches reruns of Friends, but one boot, one boot refuses to carry a cell phone, one boot knows how to cook a decent vegetarian chili, one boot might even read your palm. Though why stop there, why not 2? Believe in the boot. Embrace it as the abandoned relic of a new religion called Zen Buddhism, because the boot is alone and it is empty. It is on the way to somewhere, but also in the moment of being on the road again. Though for those who won't go that far, let us declare the boot 3, a temporary statue erected to the wandering soul, a nod to all one-legged men, or the natural result of drunkenness, except we are overlooking the odds that 4, Elvis is involved, since we know the blue suede shoe was a sign that he would be back and he might use footwear. But then what are we to make of 5? The unlikely disappearance of old Mrs. Biddle, who dips into the cooking sherry when she bakes, or at least that's what it says in the police report. And witnesses claim one afternoon in the middle of baking she went out to the road to fetch the mail, and next thing you know, all that's left of her is one boot, and the police can't make sense of it because they are unaware of standard alien policy, which is to leave one boot behind, as a sort of extraterrestrial riddle which no one ever gets. But if you happen to be 6, the philosophical sort, you'll ask, if a boot falls out the window of a car and no one sees it beside the road, is it really there? and you would have an answer, but not to the question of the lone boot, because for that you need 7, a poet, who would tell you that one boot by the roadside is a metaphor for lack, a statement of loneliness, a choice not made. The fellow could have thrown out both boots, but didn't. That the lone boot in its beautiful mystery is ultimately incomplete, as every rational explanation is incomplete, as this, too, is an incomplete. And you can't actually see it, of course, on the page, but in fact, the whole thing is one sentence that never ends. There's no period at the end, so it's all sort of hanging there.
I see. Well, this was Michelle Barker here on Scald's Hall at CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
Yes.
Marie-Joseph Angélique was the name given by her last owners to a Portuguese-born black slave in New France. She was tried and convicted of setting fire to her owner's home, burning much of what is now referred to as Old Montreal. It has recently been argued that she was in fact innocent of the crime and convicted more on the basis of her perception as a rebellious runaway slave than on the basis of factual evidence. A competing theory is that she was guilty of the crime as an act of justified rebellion against slavery. Many authors see her as an immortal avatar of liberation and prefer naturally to see her as an active rebel. Others find her just as inspiring as an exceptional, outspoken, independent-minded woman who fought for her freedom and her life against formidable odds and in spite of a society that expected submission from women, especially if they were also black and slaves.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is Scald's Hall. And we are transmitting it here from lovely Vancouver. And you know what? For those of you who are not in the Lower Mainland today, it is actually sunny. Yes, I know. As hard it is to believe, it is actually a very nice day today. And to move on to the lower half of the hour, yesterday was Valentine's Day. A day devoted to love and romance, or if you go back really, really, really far, a day devoted to feeding people whose religious views you don't agree with to lions, which is how it all started. Yes, Saint Valentine was writing to a martyr, and hence the famous sign off, "Your loving Valentine." And it's not a very happy story, but it is historically accurate. We're not going to be doing that today, though. It's a little bit too morbid. We do hear love, history, and the truth on Scald's Hall, but we also love entertainment. And today we're going to take a look at an entertaining story that was, according to my sources, originally published February 14th, 1895. It is the very, very well-known play The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde. And we already had an Oscar Wilde bit not too long ago here on Scald's Hall. However, this one was intended as a dramatic piece to start with. It was intended to be heard out loud. It was intended to be performed. And speaking as a performer, it was a lot easier to do so. And it is a lovely bit about what love means in the modern age. And even though it is creeping on to 120 years old now, its message is timeless. And the complications that people put into their love lives, I think we can all recognize. And it is just a lovely bit. So stay tuned. And in just a moment, we are going to hear the first scene of The Importance of Being Earnest here on Scald's Hall.
Here at CITR, we're
Moontan Nocturnal, vinyl consuming animals drifting easy through friendly space.
And we're
The Villains.
And
Nardwuar the Human Serviette from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
We're
Dark Space punctuated by planets.
And we're
Patrick Swayze.
And we're
God, the Devil, Hell, Heaven! Do you understand? Finally!
But CITR is not a
commercial radio station.
Which means we need the help of listeners like you. Donate to CITR's 2013 Fund Drive, February 28th to March 8th. Our goal is to raise $30,000 to help purchase new soundboards for all three studios. To donate, call 604-822-8648. That's 604-822-8648. Or go online to CITR.ca. And thanks for supporting community radio.
The Importance of Being Earnest, Act 1, Scene 1. Did you hear what I was playing, Lane?
Well, I didn't think it polite to listen, sir.
Oh, I am sorry for that, for your sake. I don't play accurately. Anyone can play accurately. But I play with wonderful expression. As far as the piano is concerned, sentiment is my forte. I keep science for life.
Yes, sir.
And speaking of the science of life, have you got the cucumber sandwiches cut for Lady Bracknell?
Yes, sir.
Oh, by the way, Lane, I see from your book that on Thursday night, when Lord Shoreman and Mr. Worthing were dining with me, 8 bottles of champagne are entered as having been consumed.
Yes, sir. 8 bottles in a pint.
Why is it that at a bachelor's establishment the servants invariably drink the champagne? I merely ask for information.
I attribute it to the superior quality of the wine, sir. I've often observed that in married households the champagne is rarely a first-rate brand.
Good heavens! Is marriage so demoralizing as that?
I believe it is a very pleasant state, sir. I've had very little experience with it myself up to the present. I have only been married once, and that was in consequence of a misunderstanding between myself and a young person.
I don't know if I'm very much interested in your family life, Lane.
No, sir, it is not a very interesting subject. I never think of it myself.
Very natural, I am sure. That will do, Lane, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Lane's views on marriage seem somewhat lax. Really, if the lower orders don't set us a good example, then what on earth is the use of them? They seem, as a class, to have absolutely no sense of moral responsibility.
Mr. Ernest Worthing.
How are you, my dear Ernest? What brings you uptown?
Oh, pleasure, pleasure. What else should bring one anywhere? Oh, eating as usual, I see, Algy.
I believe it is customary in good society to take some slight refreshment at 5 o'clock.
Where have you been since last Thursday? In the country.
And what on earth do you do there?
When one is in town, one amuses oneself. When one is in the country, one amuses other people. Ah, it is excessively boring.
And who are the people you amuse?
Oh, neighbors, neighbors.
Got nice neighbors in your part of Shropshire?
Ah, perfectly horrid. Never speak to one of them.
How immensely you must amuse them. By the way, Shropshire is your county, is it not?
Shropshire, yes, of course. Hello? Why all the cups? Why the cucumber sandwiches? Why such reckless extravagance in one so young? Who's coming to tea?
Oh, merely Aunt Augusta and Gwendolyn.
Oh, how perfectly delightful.
Yes, that is all very well, but I'm afraid Aunt Augusta won't quite approve of your being here.
May I ask why?
My dear fellow, the way you flirt with Gwendolyn is perfectly disgraceful. Indeed, it is almost as bad as the way Gwendolyn flirts with you.
I am in love with Gwendolyn. I have come uptown expressly to propose to her.
I thought you had come up for pleasure. I call that business.
How utterly unromantic you are.
I really don't see the need to be romantic in proposing. It is very romantic to be in love, but there is nothing romantic about a definite proposal. Why, one may be accepted. One usually is, I believe. Then the excitement is all over. The very essence of romance is uncertainty. If I ever get married, I shall certainly try to forget the fact at once.
Oh, I have no doubt about that, dear Algy. The divorce court was specifically invented for people whose memories are so curiously constructed.
Oh, there is no use in speculating on that subject. Divorces are made in heaven.
Oh, please don't touch the cucumber sandwiches. They're ordered specially for Aunt Augusta. Well, you've been eating them all the time.
Well, that is a very different matter. She is my aunt. Have some bread and butter. The bread and butter is for Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn is devoted to bread and butter.
Oh, and very good bread and butter it is, too.
Well, my dear fellow, you need not eat as if you were going to eat at all. You behave as if you were married already. You're not married to her already, and I don't think you ever will be.
Why on earth do you say that?
Well, in the first place, girls never marry the men they flirt with. Girls don't think it right.
Oh, that's nonsense.
It isn't. It's a great truth. It accounts for the extraordinary number of bachelors that one sees all over the place. In the second place, I don't give my consent.
Your consent?
My dear fellow, Gwendolyn is my first cousin. And before I allow you to marry her, you will have to clear up the whole question of Cecily.
Cecily? What on earth do you mean? What do you mean, Algy, by Cecily? I don't know anyone by the name of Cecily.
Lane, bring me the cigarette case Mr. Worthing left in the smoking room the last time he was here.
Yes, sir.
Do you mean to say you've had my cigarette case all this time? I wish to goodness you had let me know. I've been writing frantic letters to Scotland Yard about it. Was very nearly offering a large reward.
Well, I wish you would offer one. I happen to be more than usually hard up.
There's no good in offering a large reward now that the thing is found.
I think that is rather mean of you, Ernest, I must say. However, it makes no matter, for now that I look at the inscription inside, I find that the thing isn't yours after all.
Well, of course it's mine. You've seen me with it 100 times, and you have no right whatsoever to read what's written inside. It is a very ungentlemanly thing to read the inside of a private cigarette case.
Oh, it is observed to have hard and fast rules about what one should read and what one shouldn't. More than half of modern culture depends on what one shouldn't read.
Oh, I'm quite aware of that fact. And I don't propose to discuss modern culture. It is the sort of thing that one shouldn't talk about in private. I simply want my cigarette case back.
Yes, but this isn't your cigarette case. This cigarette case is a present from someone by the name of Cecily, and you said you didn't know anyone of that name.
Well, if you must know, Cecily happens to be my aunt.
Your aunt?
Yes. Charming old lady she is, too. Lives in Tunbridge Wells. Just give it back to me, Algy. But why does she call herself Little Cecily, if she is your aunt who lives in Tunbridge Wells? From Little Cecily, with her fondest love. My dear fellow, what on earth is there in that? Some aunts are tall, some aunts are not tall. This is a matter that surely an aunt must be allowed to decide for herself. You seem to think that every aunt should be exactly like yours. That's absurd. For heaven's sake, give me back my cigarette case.
Yes, but why does your aunt call you her uncle? From Little Cecily, with her fondest love, to her dear Uncle Jack.
There is no objection, I admit, in an aunt being small, but why an aunt, no matter what her size may be, should call her own nephew her uncle, I can't quite make out. Besides, your name isn't Jack at all, it's Ernest.
It isn't Ernest. It's Jack.
You have always told me it was Ernest. I've introduced you to everyone as Ernest. You answer to the name of Ernest. You look as if your name is Ernest. You're the most earnest-looking person I have ever seen in my life. It is perfectly absurd. You're saying that your name isn't Ernest. It's on your cards. Here's one of them. I'll keep this as proof that your name is Ernest if you ever attempt to deny it to me or Gwendolyn or anyone else.
Wait a minute. My name is Ernest in town and Jack in the country. The cigarette case was given to me in the country.
Yes, but that does not account for the fact that your small Aunt Cecily, who lives in Tunbridge Wells, calls you her dear uncle. Come, old boy, you had better have the thing out at once.
My dear Elgie, you talk exactly as if you were a dentist. It is very vulgar to talk like a dentist when one isn't a dentist. It produces a false impression.
Well, that is exactly what dentists always do. Now go on. Tell me the whole thing, and I may mention that I've always suspected you of being a confirmed and secret Bunburyist.
I'm quite sure of it now.
Bunburyist? What on earth do you mean by a Bunburyist? I'll reveal to you the meaning of that incomparable expression as soon as you are kind enough to inform me why you are Ernest in town and Jack in the country.
Well, produce my cigarette case first.
Here it is. Now, produce your explanation.
And pray, make it improbable. My dear fellow, there is nothing improbable about my explanation at all. In fact, it is perfectly ordinary. Mr. Thomas Cardew, who adopted me when I was a little boy, made me in his will guardian to his granddaughter, Miss Cecily Cardew. Cecily, who addresses me as her uncle for motives of respect which you could not possibly appreciate, lives at my place in the country under the charge of her admirable governess, Miss Prism.
Where is that place in the country, by the way?
That is nothing to you, dear boy. You are not going to be invited. I may tell you candidly that it is not in Shropshire.
I suspected that, my dear fellow. I have bunburied all over Shropshire on two separate occasions. Now go on. Why are you Ernest in town and Jack in the country?
My dear Elgie, I don't know whether you will be able to understand my real motives. You are hardly serious enough. When one is placed in a position of guardian, one has to adopt a very high moral tone on all subjects. It is one's duty to do so. And, as a high moral tone can hardly be said to conduce very much either to one's health or to one's happiness, in order to get up into town, I have always pretended to have a younger brother, who goes by the name of Ernest, and who lives in the Albany, and who gets into the most dreadful scrapes. That, my dear Elgie, is the whole truth. Pure and simple.
The truth is rarely pure, and never simple. Modern life would be very tedious if it were either, and modern literature would be a complete impossibility.
That wouldn't be a bad thing at all.
Literary criticism is not your forte, my dear fellow. Don't try it. You should leave it to the people who haven't been to a university. They're so well into it in the daily papers. What you really are is a Bunburyist. I was quite right in saying you were a Bunburyist. You are one of the most advanced Bunburyists I know. What on earth do you mean? You have invented a very useful younger brother called Ernest, in order that you may come up into town as often as you like. I have invented an invaluable permanent invalid called Bunbury, in order that I may be able to go down into the countryside whenever I choose. Bunbury is perfectly invaluable. If it wasn't for Bunbury's extraordinarily bad health, for instance, I wouldn't be able to dine with you at Willis's tonight, for I have been so recently engaged to my Aunt Augusta for a week. I haven't asked you to dine with me anywhere tonight. I know. You are absurdly careless about sending out invitations. It is very foolish of you. Nothing annoys people so much as not receiving invitations. You had much better dine with your Aunt Augusta.
I haven't the slightest intention of doing anything of the kind. To begin with, I dine there on Monday, and once a week is quite enough to dine with one's own relations. In the second place, whenever I do dine there, I am always treated as a member of the family and set down with either no women at all or with two. In the third place, I know perfectly well with whom she will place me next to tonight. She will place me next to Mary Farquhar, who always flirts with her own husband across the dinner table. That is not very pleasant. Indeed, it is not even decent, and that sort of thing is enormously on the increase. The amount of women in London who flirt with their own husbands is perfectly scandalous. It looks so bad. It is simply washing one's clean linen in public. Besides, now that I know you to be a confirmed Bunburyist, I naturally want to talk to you about Bunburying. I want to tell you the rules. I'm not a Bunburyist at all. If Gwendolyn accepts me, I'm going to kill my brother. Indeed, I think I'll kill him in any case. Cecily's a little too much interested in him. It is rather a bore, so I'm going to get rid of Ernest. And I strongly advise you to do the same with Mr. Whatever your invalid friend is with the absurd name.
Nothing will induce me to part with Bunbury, and if you ever get married, which seems to me extremely problematic, you will be very glad to know Bunbury. A man who marries without knowing Bunbury has a very tedious time of it.
Pshaw, that is nonsense. If I marry a charming girl like Gwendolyn, and she's the only girl I ever saw in my life I would like to marry, I certainly wouldn't want to know Bunbury.
Then your wife will. You don't seem to realize that in married life, three is company and two is none.
That, my dear young friend, is the theory of the corrupt French drama that has been propounding for the last 50 years.
Yes, and that the happy English home has proved in half that time.
Oh, for heaven's sake, don't try to be so cynical. It is perfectly easy to be cynical.
My dear fellow, it isn't easy to be anything nowadays. There's such a lot of beastly competition about it.
Ah,
that must be Aunt Augusta. Only relatives or creditors would ever ring in that Wagnerian manner. Now, if I get her out of the way for 10 minutes, so that you can have an opportunity for proposing to Gwendolyn, might I dine with you tonight at Willis's?
I suppose so, if you want.
Yes, but you must be serious about it. I hate people who are not serious about meals. It is so shallow of them.
Here at CITR, we're
Moontan Nocturnal, vinyl consuming animals drifting easy through friendly space.
And we're
the villains.
And
Nardwuar the human serviette from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
We're
dark space punctuated by planets.
And we're
Patrick Swayze.
And we're
God, the devil, hell, heaven! Do you understand? Finally!
But CITR is not a
commercial radio station.
Which means we need the help of listeners like you. Donate to CITR's 2013 fund drive, February 28th to March 8th. Our goal is to raise $30,000 to help purchase new soundboards for all three studios. To donate, call 604-822-8648. That's 604-822-8648. Or go online to citr.ca. And thanks for supporting community radio.
And welcome back to the live portion of Us on Skull Tall at CITR 101.9 FM. We are just a few minutes from the top of the hour of 2 o'clock. And you were just listening to a slightly belated Valentine's Day special. The first scene of The Importance of Being Earnest, which is a lovely play if you ever get a chance to see it or read it or view it or experience it in any way. And as you can see there, sometimes we make our lives far more complicated than perhaps we need to. But as Lysander once said, the course of true love never does run smooth. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, we have a few events that are on the way. As you just heard, the CITR 101.9 Fun Drive is going to be starting in a couple of weeks, and there's going to be some events that are going to be held around that. So if you love the idea of having radio stations that can play programs like this, or the lovely music programs we have, or the excellent news, sports, and arts programs, they require your help to continue. And so that is a very good cause, and that's going to be coming up the next couple of weeks. Also, the Vagabond Players production of Fawlty Towers is slated to open on February 28th. That's Thursday, February 28th. Will be opening night of the Vagabond Players production of Fawlty Towers. And as a very special guest, next week we are going to have, actually as special guests, plural, next week we're going to have several of the cast members of that production on our show, including, as I have already mentioned, myself and several other of the principal cast members. And we're going to get a little bit of a chance to talk about what we're doing, what we hope to accomplish, what it's like to be an actor in town, and if we're very lucky, hopefully we'll be able to give everyone a bit of a preview. So keep your eye open on the Vagabond Players production website. They already have information about the play up. You can go there if you're interested in purchasing tickets, if you're interested in checking it out. I personally think it's well worth the time. And of course, I'm exceedingly biased in that, but I wouldn't have gotten involved if I didn't think it was a good idea. Beyond that, if you have not checked out the FanBuilt project, they are moving on. They are beginning to accept proposals for their first projects. And so, if you are an animator, a 3D visual artist, a animation storyboard artist, a voiceover actor, a writer who understands television teleplays, a budding children's writer, if you have developed any of the sorts of skills that you think might come in handy in the actual production of a real live children's television show or an animation show, you definitely should be checking out the FanBuilt project, because they've gotten to the point now where they're beginning to seriously consider the first things that they're going to be building up. I know that they ran their first contest for animated GIFs to start off just to get things tested. And now they're moving on to looking for potential projects to back that are a little bit more substantial and that will end up being financed by the big boys, that will end up being actual, real, live, fully produced animated productions. And so if you would like to have your name onto one of those, then that's the project that you should be checking out. And so we're just now a couple of minutes away from the top of the hour here at CITR 101.9 FM in unusually and almost abnormally sunny Vancouver here on the BC coast. And coming up in just a moment, and they're already here, we have Tyler.